pleasure to be here.
Let us join in prayer. Gracious Lord, we do give you thanks for this beautiful day, for this time that we can be in each other's company, for this opportunity to grow in knowledge, love, and fellowship. I would ask your blessing upon us, our speaker this day, in this time of sharing with her, the food we're about to receive in the hands prepared. For all these gifts, we give you thanks in Jesus' name. Amen.
Before we start, one quick ground rule. If you want to ask a question, you must have the microphone in your hand or she will not hear you ask the question. So raise your hand, we'll bring you the mic, and you can do whatever you want to do.
Well, good morning. Can you hear me? Is it on? I probably could just stand here, but, Beppa won't?
Okay. I can hear you.
Oh, that's right. Well, as you can close your ears, Vapa, but this introduction may be peppered with great nepotism. But anyway, you're used to that. I've mentioned it already in the service. Officially, Vapa went to medical school in Iran and served as a GP there for several years. And then she found her way to Toronto and settled on being an endocrinologist and did some thyroid research at Montefiore. They recruited her. And so she went there and served a residency and fellowship there and then was joined the faculty. She served as clerkship director for medical students, beginning their clinical rotations in the hospital. She became a fellowship director and then clinical director for the Division of Endocrinology. And I know she's still very, very much involved in selecting and nurturing fellows in the Department of Endocrinology. She started a fracture liaison service at Monte, as she says, Montefiore, and it identifies and treats patients who have had fractures. She's been lecturing about osteoporosis since 2013 at Montefiore, at Albert Einstein Medical School of Medicine, where she also teaches. She has talked at the Special Hospital for Special Surgery, Northwell, Emory. In other words, she's, I would say, a fairly good expert in the field of osteoporosis. Now you'll be able to ask questions, and Beth said she doesn't care if it's during the program or after. So just that you will have to have the microphone. So without further ado, I present you with Vapa. Our older son in 2020 decided his aging parents needed a medical advisor in-house. So we never look back. We're happy to have her here, AKA Vapa Tabatabi, MD.
Thank you so much. That was a lovely, lovely introduction. I'm very, very happy to be here and speaking to you all. I wish I was able to be there in person, and hopefully at some point I'll be able to meet as well. So I just want to make sure that you see my screen that says osteoporosis, let's bone up. Yeah. All right, very good. I heard yeah, the-
We see it.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to talk about osteoporosis and what it is and why is it important and how we identify it and how we treat it. Obviously, as you can imagine, this is going to be a little bit of a general talk, but I'm happy to answer any questions that might be a little bit more specific. You can interrupt me, grab the microphone, or wait until the end, however you prefer. So the definition of osteoporosis basically was developed at the NIH back in 1990s, and this was kind of the official definition of it. We knew about osteoporosis before that as well, but they kind of like had a consensus meeting and came up with this definition, which is osteoporosis is a skeletal disorder that means that individual has compromised bone strength, and as a result of that, would be at an increased risk of having fractures. The reason why most people develop osteoporosis is that they lose bone at some point during their life, and we'll get to talk a little bit about that in more detail. But basically, looking at these pictures that were obtained by micrograph, if you look at the normal bone on the left-hand side and then the osteoporotic bone on the right-hand side, it's very easy to see why the osteoporotic bone is more fragile. So this is obviously a picture taken with a microphone, so it's magnified, but you can see that there are these like plates and ridges and pillars of bone in a normal bone. There's like little hole things in it too. It's kind of almost looks like a Swiss cheese. And in an osteoporotic bone, you'll see that you just generally have less bone. You have less of these plates and rods, we call them. And even the ones that are there are just thinner than the normal bone. So it's obvious, very easy to imagine that if you put a little pressure on the normal bone, and if you put the same amount of pressure on the osteoporotic bone would break more easily. Now, we diagnose osteoporosis with this test, which is called the bone density test. And I'm sure many of you have already had it or know somebody who has had a bone density test. Bone density test is very simple. It's non-invasive, so there is no like poking or needle or nothing involved. It uses X-ray, and the machine is called a DXA machine, dual X-ray absorptiometry machine. And as I said, it's non-invasive. Usually the patient gets pictures taken of their back, of their hip, and sometimes also of their forearm. And the amount of X-ray that is delivered through the machine is actually very small. The X-ray exposure when you get a bone density test is about a fifth of what you get exposed to when you get a simple chest X-ray. So it's very safe. Most people start having bone density tests kind of later in life. And in some people, they start earlier, especially if they've had fractures or if they have other people in their family who have osteoporosis or have had fractures. Usually they start getting bone density tests earlier. The official recommendations by U.S. Preventive Task Force is that any woman at age 65 should start getting a bone density test. Again, for some people, they might actually have to start a little earlier, but that's kind of like the minimum required. Unfortunately, the U.S. Preventive Task Force does not have official recommendations for men, but most physicians and most professional medical societies, such as Endocrine Society or American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists, et cetera, they believe that men also should start at age 70. Again, some people might need to have that done earlier, and we'll see examples of why somebody might need to get bone densities earlier. But definitely women after 65, and many physicians believe men as well after age 70. So when you get a bone density test, you get a picture that kind of looks like this. This is just a sample of the picture from the patient's spine. This is actually a patient of mine. And the part that tells whether the patient has osteoporosis or not is this kind of like a colored block on the right-hand side. They also provide some numbers too, but even not knowing what the numbers actually indicate, just looking at the picture, it's pretty easy to see that these dots basically fall in the red zone. And if it's in the red zone, it means that that individual has osteoporosis. And you'll see that here they even indicate that it means that their fracture risk is high. If it falls on the green area, it means that they have a normal bone density and their fracture risk is not increased. It doesn't mean that they won't break a bone. Obviously, anybody, even young people, kids, teenagers, if they have a forceful enough trauma, everybody can break a bone. But the problem with osteoporosis is that you can break a bone more easily than otherwise. And if it falls in the yellow area, which is kind of between normal and osteoporosis, and we call it osteopenia, it also means that the bone, the risk of fracture is a little bit higher, but not as high as you would expect in osteoporosis. So this is a picture that, you know, anybody can look at and kind of see where their osteoporosis risk falls on. Might appear in different companies and different manufacturers of these bone density machines might look a little bit different from each other, but it's always like a green and a yellow and a red area. So it's pretty easy to see that this patient, for example, this is the most current bone density test and it's in the osteoporosis area. And the one before that, which was done a few years before. So here you see the patient was like almost 84 years old. And even when they were 81, they had osteoporosis at that time too. And so depending on how many bone densities you've had in that facility, you might see multiple of these dots. Or if it's your first one, you will only see one dot. Now, another way to
ask the question.
Sure.
On that green, yellow, red screen.
Mm-hmm.
I can't see what the X and the Y axis markings are for clearly, but how does the doctor know, okay, this part is in the green, but this part is in the red. So how do they know which is red and which is green?
So the square kind of comes pre-drawn by the machine. And then when the individual gets their bone density test, the machine measures their bone density and puts this dot where it belongs. So the x-axis is age and the y-axis is BMD or bone mineral density. So this person, for example, at this first time the bone density was measured, they were 81 years old. So it's right here. And their bone mineral density was like 0.7. So this dot falls in the red area. So it's really, it's the machine that determines where they fall at. The doctor or the patient can just look at the picture and kind of see where they fall at. I hope I answered your question.
Thanks.
Sure. So the other way that we sometimes end up diagnosing osteoporosis, unfortunately, is if somebody comes with a fracture. Now, as I mentioned, anybody can break a bone. If, you know, even people who are completely healthy and have a normal bone density and very strong bones, if they have a forceful enough trauma, they can break a bone. But the problem in osteoporosis is that you can break a bone with even very small traumas or minor traumas. And we call that kind of fracture, we call them fragility fracture. So fragility fracture means that the reason we think that individual broke their bone is that the bone is fragile and it's not because that trauma was very heavy and forceful. So, you know, if anybody is in a car accident, for example, they can break a bone and it doesn't necessarily mean that their bones were fragile. If it was a, you know, severe car accident, anybody can break a bone. Or, you know, if somebody falls from a ladder or if somebody falls from like stairs, anybody can break a bone. But if an individual breaks their bone by a simple fall from standing height, so that's the official definition of a fragility fracture, is a fracture that happens as a result of a low force trauma, such as fall from standing height. And as you can imagine, I'm sure you have heard, most people who have osteoporosis and break their bones, that's exactly how they break it. You know, they're walking in their bathroom or they're walking in their kitchen or they're walking in the street and they trip over something and they fall and they break a bone. So although that was an accident, but it was a low trauma accident. And that in and of itself means that they have osteoporosis. Now, if somebody falls from like a ladder and they have a fracture, we might not be able to definitively say whether it's because of the fragility of their bones or is it because of the fact that the ladder was really high. So sometimes it might be a little difficult to determine that, but if somebody is just walking, or even more simple than that, let's say they are sitting in a chair and they fall from the chair or they fall from their bed. So even a smaller height, if somebody falls from a standing height or smaller and has a fracture, then that would definitely mean that they have osteoporosis. So in a situation like this, technically, you don't even need a bone density to say that somebody has osteoporosis because they are already showing you that their bone is brittle. But of course, you can get a bone density to see where they are in that spectrum. Is it just a little bit of osteoporosis or is it very severe osteoporosis, which sometimes can help in deciding what kind of treatment that patient needs. So some extreme examples of people breaking their bones when they have osteoporosis is the trivial trauma. So people who have severe osteoporosis can even break their bones with sneezing or coughing, let's say when they have a cold, or even minor bumps. So they are in a car, they are, driving down the road, and there's a little bump, and they, they go over the bump and then they immediately start having back pain. And you get an x-ray and you see that they have a fracture in one of their vertebrae in their spine. Or as I said, with sneezing or coughing, they start developing pain on their side and you get an x-ray and you see that they have a rib fracture. So it's pretty easy, and I'm sure everybody agrees that that's really not normal. All throughout our lives, when we're younger, we sneeze and cough all the time and we don't break anything. But when we get older and we develop osteoporosis, even with a sneeze or a cough, we can break a bone. So that is a telltale sign and meant basically just indicates that that individual has brittle bones or fragile bones and osteoporosis. So why does osteoporosis happen? So we're going to go kind of a little bit into the structure of the bone and see what happens. When we think about the bone, in the first thought that comes to mind is that it's just this like solid structure, almost like a stone or a brick. But in reality, bone is a live tissue. And, a lot of things that happen in many other tissues in the body happen in the bone too, including kind of this process of repair and regeneration. So this goes out throughout all of our life since, we're a baby, and goes on until the very end of our life. So this process of regeneration and repair of the bone happens all throughout the life. So when we're younger, there are these cells that are called osteoclasts, and these are the cleanup guys. So they come in and they remove old bone or damaged bone. And then these other guys come in that are called osteoblasts. And what they do is that they lay down new and healthy bone. So when I talk to the students, I kind of tell them it's like these crews that come to repair the road, for example. First, there's a group of people that come in and remove the old asphalt. And then there's another group of people that come in and lay down the new surface. And so you'll end up with a brand new shiny road. Exactly the same thing happens in the bone. So these guys come in, remove the old bone, and then these guys come in and lay down the new bone. So when we're younger, they work perfectly together. So these osteoclasts that are the cleanup guys remove some bone and the other ones come in and lay down exactly the same amount of bone that was removed. So you end up with a bone that looks brand new and shiny and healthy. What happens when we get older, and also in some other conditions, which I will talk about in a minute, is that you'll see that the cleanup guys are suddenly more numerous than the repair guys. So the osteoclasts remove a bunch of bone, and they kind of like are more active and more rigorous than the osteoblasts. So these guys kind of fall behind. So when we're healthy, the bone that we remove is equal to the bone that we form. And but when we get older, we remove more bone than we can repair. So as a result, the net effect of that is that we lose bone. Another way to think about it is like a bank account. If you withdraw an amount of money and then you put down the same amount of money, you'll end up with the same amount of money in your bank account. But if you withdraw more that you put in, you'll end up with like a deficit. And this is exactly what happens as we get older. So as a result, with this repair process going on in younger age, you'll have a healthy bone. But when we get older, we end up with an osteoporotic bone because we're removing more bone than we can repair. And so as a result, the bones kind of thin out and become fragile. So I repeatedly said, when we get older, when we get older. So this is actually a just aging. And I'm not even talking about when we get old. This process starts when we're in our 30s. So when we're young and as a child, we just make more and more and more bone. That's how we grow. And then when we get to our kind of early 20s, we almost reach a plateau. And then by mid to late 20s is when that process of losing more bone than making more bone, so the net bone loss starts to happen. So it's kind of like when I say aging, it doesn't mean like really like old aging. It's just the process of years going by, even starting in our 30s, the bone loss starts to happen. And there are several other things that kind of can potentially accelerate that bone loss. And the most common one in women is menopause. So after menopause, because the hormone estrogen is not around anymore, and estrogen is like food for bone. So you end up in a situation that you're losing more bone that you're able to actually regenerate. And there are a lot of other reasons why people can lose more bone and not be able to keep up with regenerating the bone, such as a lot of medications, for example, steroids. And this really just applies to long-term use of steroids. So if you have an allergy and you take a steroid for 3-4 days, that's not an issue. But we're talking about months and months of steroid use. Also, lifestyle has a lot to do with it. So for example, being sedentary predisposes us to more bone loss. Smoking and excessive alcohol, and by excessive, I mean more than 3 drinks a day on a kind of like a regular basis, can also predispose us to losing more bone than we can actually make. And there are a lot of other illnesses that can contribute to bone loss. So one example of it for would be overactive thyroid gland. If somebody has an overactive thyroid gland and it's not appropriately treated and they're constantly hyperthyroid, they can lose bone. Another example of it is COPD, for example, emphysema, which sometimes is a result of smoking. So it's kind of like a double whammy. The smoking affects the bone and the COPD in and of itself affects the bone. So there are a lot of other medical conditions that can predispose us to increased bone loss. And so as time goes by with more medication and more illnesses, sometimes this kind of accumulates. So why is osteoporosis important? Why are we talking about all of these things? Well, first of all, osteoporosis is very common. The information that I'm giving you is from Bone Health and Osteoporosis Foundation, or BHOF. They actually have a really nice website, and I encourage everybody to take a look. They have a section that is for patients. And there is like information about what is osteoporosis and how common it is and how we treat it and what are the questions to ask your doctor, et cetera, et cetera. And so these information are, majority of it is from that website. They used to be called National Osteoporosis Foundation. So it's a scientific organization. So as of this moment, we have about 54 million Americans who have osteoporosis. And in fact, one out of every two women and one out of every four men older than 50 will break a bone due to osteoporosis during the remainder of their life. So it's a very common problem. And I have never been in any forum that I talked about osteoporosis and somebody didn't know somebody else, at least, who has had a fracture. So we've all known people who've had broken bones. The other issue is that it's actually very serious. You know, we kind of sometimes think about, oh, you know, you break your bone and then, you know, you get a surgery and then it gets fixed. But in reality, it could be much more complicated. It's easy to imagine that fracture can lead to pain. It can lead to limited mobility. It can lead to loss of independence, at least temporarily. So people will end up not being able to do what they normally do. They go out, they hang out with their friends, they go walking or, you know, go shopping for themselves, go, you know, cook their own food, bathe themselves. And a fracture can very easily limit our ability to do all of those things. And that could be quite problematic and lead to isolation and depression as well. Also, the most serious kind of fracture, which is a hip fracture, in seniors can actually lead to death in up to 20% of patients when they have a hip fracture because of the complications of the hip fracture, complications of the surgery, complications of the medication that they need to take after hip surgery. Usually they need to be on blood thinners and sometimes that causes complications, infection, and again, immobilization. It just kind of snowballs it, and it's truly distressing to see somebody who is independent and taking care of themselves and having a full life now suddenly gets deprived of a lot of those activities and again, can potentially have serious consequences as a result of the fracture. So osteoporosis is common and it's serious and it's very costly. So as you can imagine, majority of the cost of osteoporosis care is paid by Medicare. This data is actually from Surgeon General's report that came out in 2004. At that time, annually, they spent $18 billion taking care of osteoporosis-related fractures and the surgery and the hospital stay. And I don't know about you, but I have a little difficulty imagining what is $18 billion. So basically, it's a stack of $1 bills from New York, where I am, to St. Louis, Missouri. So it's about 1,100 miles high. So that's a lot of money, I can tell you that. And actually, this data is from 2004, and this cost is projected to get to $25 billion by 2025, which is just around the corner. And the other reason that osteoporosis is so important is that it can actually sneak up on you. Osteoporosis really is what we call a silent disease. So it doesn't cause any pain or discomfort. Most of the pain that we experience in our joints is like wear and tear, and it's actually osteoarthritis. It's not osteoporosis. So osteoporosis doesn't cause any symptom, and then suddenly we fall and we have a fracture. So fracture could be the first sign. And these fractures, when they happen in the spine, can actually lead to a curvature in the spine or can lead to loss of height. And that could also be an early sign. But a lot of people don't even experience that. They just like suddenly have a fracture in their arm or leg or somewhere. It just to kind of like mention this, that we all lose a little bit of height as we get older. And that's because between the bones in our spine, between our vertebra, we have disc. And disc is like a little cushion, kind of like jelly. And it has a lot of water in it. And as we get older, we lose a little bit of that water. So the cushion jelly becomes a little thinner. And, you know, we have 30 something discs in our back. So each one of them, if they lose like 1 millimeter of their height, it's going to come to like a few centimeters or like an inch or so. So a little bit of height loss, everybody will experience it. But if it's more than 2 to 4 inches, then it could actually be because of fracture of the bone in the back and not just thinning of the disc. So it, you know, we don't feel anything, so it can sneak up on you. That's another reason why it's important to be aware of osteoporosis and be proactive about identifying it and treating it. Any questions so far? I hope I haven't freaked out everybody.
No, I think we're good. Thanks.
Okay.
Right now.
Okay. So we're going to talk a little bit about what to do to prevent and treat osteoporosis. And the first part is about prevention and treatment. So the part that we talk about calcium and vitamin D and lifestyle applies to everybody. Even if you don't have osteoporosis and you want to prevent it, those apply to everybody. The part about medication would be for treatment of osteoporosis. So these are recommendations for treatment of osteoporosis and prevention of osteoporosis that apply to everybody. So the first two is about calcium and vitamin D, and everybody has heard that. Calcium and vitamin D are really like building blocks for the bone. So obviously, if you want to have a strong bone, you need to have enough building blocks. So that's the reason why we always talk about making sure that you have adequate intake of calcium and vitamin D. And you notice that it says throughout life because it's important for prevention of osteoporosis too. Consuming a balanced diet, it basically means like the diet that includes various kinds of nutrients, including fresh vegetables and fresh fruit, and not like a diet that is heavily reliant on prepared meals and like cold cuts or, you know, cans and things like that. Because they can have a high amount of salt in them, and salt can make you lose calcium, is not good for bone health. We'll talk about weight-bearing exercise. I think the tobacco and alcohol, avoiding tobacco in general and kind of moderation in alcohol use is clear for everybody. And we'll talk about the rest of this in more detail as well. So calcium, there are a lot of good sources of calcium in the food. Many, many individuals can get enough calcium from food, meaning that not everybody necessarily needs to take a calcium supplement. So what are the sources of calcium in food? The main sources of calcium is dairy products, so milk and yogurt and cheese and ice cream, but also plant-based milk. So if sometimes people can't have regular dairy because of gastrointestinal issues or might not like it or are trying to watch their cholesterol, so they don't want to, you know, have a lot of milk. Plant-based milk like soy milk, coconut milk, almond milk, oat milk, there is like a lot of different kinds of it. As long as it says milk, it has calcium in it. So it either has calcium or it's fortified with calcium. So if you don't like milk or you're watching your cholesterol, and don't want to have milk and you don't like skim milk, for example, one of those plant-based milks might be a good option. And, you know, sometimes we need to get a little creative with it because not everybody likes the taste of milk. So, you know, you can make a smoothie, put some fruits in it. Usually I'm able to kind of find something that people like to eat. But just remember that sometimes we need to get a little creative because not everybody likes the same kind of food. The other really good source of calcium in food is green leafy vegetables. So basically anything that is green, including broccoli, green beans, but more so in green leafy vegetables like spinach, kale, Swiss chard, you know, any kind of leafy vegetable has a lot of calcium in it. So these are the main sources of calcium, dairy and greens. But there is a little bit of calcium in many other things. So for example, orange has calcium in it. Almonds have calcium in them. And a lot of cereals are fortified with calcium. So they add calcium to the cereal. Orange juice, a lot of types of orange juice are also fortified with calcium and vitamin D. So basically, in order to make sure you get enough calcium, if you eat one or two things that have a good amount of calcium in them, like dairy and greens, then you will get enough calcium, a little bit from this and a little bit from that and a little bit from the orange and a little bit from the almond. And overall, you'll be able to get enough calcium just from your food. Now, we all have dietary restrictions or might have limitations in eating certain things because of medical conditions or personal preference. So there could be a situation where if you can't really have enough calcium from food, then some patients might actually need to take supplements. But not everybody needs to take calcium supplements because many of us can actually get enough calcium from food. Now, vitamin D is kind of almost the opposite, meaning that there's actually not a lot of good amount of vitamin D in food. There's really just, you know, a few kinds of fish and like maybe butter that has vitamin D in it. And basically, you really can't get enough vitamin D just by relying on food. Main source of vitamin D is actually sunlight. And lucky for you guys, you live in beautiful Utah and you probably have much better sunlight exposure than we do over here. Although I know that a lot of times of the year, because it's too hot, you might not be able to go out and have good sun exposure because of the temperature. So, you know, in New York, on the other hand, we have a lot of cloudy days. And so we also can't get enough sun exposure. Plus the fact that, you know, I mean, I spend most of my day indoors. So even on the days that there is good sunlight, I might not actually have exposure to it. So because of that, a lot of people, depending on where they live, probably less so for you folks, but definitely for people who live in Northeast United States, a lot of people need to be on vitamin D supplement. Now, we need to be careful not to overdo vitamin D because vitamin D is one of the vitamins that we actually store in our body. So if we take too much of it, we can actually end up having too much vitamin D. So you got to be careful not to overdo it. But the good news is that there is a blood test that your doctor can order and measure your vitamin D level to make sure that you're on a good amount, not too little and not too much. Now, exercise, they say this fancy word of weight-bearing exercise. So all it really means is doing something that you're kind of carrying your own weight. And that could be something as simple as just walking. It could be a high-impact weight-bearing exercise like jogging or dancing, or it could be a low-impact weight-bearing exercise, just like walking or hiking. And you don't really have to do a ton of it either. Like basically half an hour of walking a day most days of the week is all you need. So you don't necessarily have to be doing some kind of like an extraordinary physical activity in order to get the benefit for your bones. Now, if you do more, then great. If you, you know, like to do yoga or et cetera, that would also be beneficial. But don't stress out if you can't do all of those extra things and you just walk 20 minutes a day. That's good enough for your bones. Just be careful not to fall. Talking about fall, most of the falls actually happen at home. So very important that we all take a look around our house to make sure we kind of don't put booby traps for ourselves. So loose rugs. So either just get rid of the rug or make sure that it's kind of sturdy and fixed to the floor. Try not to climb. And if you have to climb to get something from the top shelf, use a sturdy step stool, or ideally something that has a bar that you can hold on to. So climbing chairs probably is not a good idea. You know, you can consider having grab bars in the bathroom, you know, have a night light on. Even if you live in the same house for 20 years and you know exactly where you're going when you wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, you know, if there's something there that is not supposed to be there and you're not used to it, you can trip and fall over it. So try to have a night light on, or just turn the night light on when you're getting up. And also, this is the problem these days, that we all get distracted when we're walking, you know, cell phone and things like that. So I always tell my patients that when you're walking, you have one job, and that is to walk. So don't be on your phone and, you know, other things. Don't get distracted. And also, don't be shy to get help, meaning that, you know, hold on to something if you're walking somewhere that you're not so sure, going up the stairs or down the stairs, or it's rainy or slippery outside. I always hold on to the handrail while I'm going up and down the stairs. So just kind of being aware that, hey, got to pay a little bit more attention to what I'm doing right now. So everything that we just talked about is about, applies to prevention and treatment of osteoporosis. But if you do actually have osteoporosis, or you've had a fragility fracture, in addition to calcium and vitamin D and exercise and being careful about not falling, many patients need medication in order to treat the osteoporosis and have a meaningful improvement in their bone density and their bone strength. The good news is that we have a lot of options for treatment of osteoporosis, many, many more than we had 10 years ago. So for majority of people, we can find something that works for them and that they're comfortable with. We have pills, we have injections, and we have to always, this applies to everything, not just in medicine, but in life, we always balance the risk and benefit when we're trying to decide about something. But when we choose the patient correctly, so somebody who actually has osteoporosis and actually has an increased risk of fracture, and we choose the medication for them correctly, and we monitor them correctly while they're on the medication, these medications are safe and effective. They increase the bone density and they decrease the risk of fracture. We probably underutilize the tools that we have in terms of medication management, because physicians and patients are worried about side effects. And this is true about all medications. So this is a cutout from the newspaper from 2016 that they were talking about osteoporosis treatment and how sometimes patients are scared of the side effects and decide not to take the medication. And basically, they take their chances and end up having fractures sometimes. The fact of the matter is that, again, as I said, if you choose the patient correctly and you choose the medication correctly and you monitor the patient, these side effects are quite rare. And they did highlight that in the title of the article too. It said, if you have access to New York Times archives, it's an interesting read. And they talk to different people about like, what are the medications that they have tried or why they don't want to try it and what are the concerns that they have. Partially it's because there are a couple of side effects of osteoporosis medication that sound really scary. And we've all heard about them. And the good news is that those really scary side effects are really rare. So this is a picture that kind of shows this. I don't know whether you can see it or not, but these little circles are supposed to be people. So one of the side effects of some of the osteoporosis medication, some of the most commonly used ones that you must have heard their name, like Fosamax and Boniva and et cetera, one of the side effects that everybody's very scared of is this condition that is called osteonecrosis of the jaw. And it basically means that if you get some sort of a tooth procedure or extraction or implant or something, that area could heal very slowly and therefore can get infected. And there are like really terrible pictures of it on the internet if you Google it. The reality is that the risk of developing osteonecrosis of the jaw in patients who take osteoporosis medication is less than 1 out of 10,000 to 100,000 patients who take osteoporosis medication. So I deal with a lot of osteoporosis. I have never seen a case of it. I'm knocking on wood right now for myself and my patients, but bottom line is that it's very rare. It can happen, but again, it's the balancing of the risk and the benefit. So this left side picture shows the risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw is that little green head. And the right picture shows the risk of fracture. So an untreated case of osteoporosis, remember, 1 out of every 2 women can have a fracture. So it's very clear what's the risk and what's the benefit. It's pretty easy to choose. The other pretty scary side effect of some classes of osteoporosis medication, not all of them, but some of them that are very commonly used and we're all heard of them, like the Fosamax, for example, is this atypical femur fracture, which is when you think about it, you take these medications to prevent fractures. So if the medication actually causes the fracture, it's horrible. It's a terrible, terrible experience for the patient and for the physician, and really disheartening. That is also very, very rare. So you can see it's like less than 1 in 1,000. So again, if you correctly choose the patient and monitor them correctly while they're on treatment, the benefit of taking osteoporosis medication for someone who has osteoporosis, especially if they have already had a fracture, is way, way lower than the risk of these rare side effects. So I just wanted to show you the actual data that was published. This was published in Canadian Family Physician Journal, but they basically, up here is the risk of those side effects that we talked about, and down here is the risk of fractures. And, you know, they've categorized it in low risk, high risk, medium risk, whatever. Doesn't matter. Just compare the bottom of the picture to the top of the picture. And for kind of giggles, they also put some other things. So, for example, this is the risk of osteonecrosis of the jaw, which is 1 out of 100,000 person years of treatment. And you'll see that it's kind of similar to the risk of death by murder, which, you know, nobody's saying it's good, but it's very, very low risk. And definitely the risk is lower than a fracture in an individual who hasn't been treated. So just like any other medication that you take for many other medical conditions, there are do's and don'ts. There are things to monitor and things to be aware of. But in general, if you take the correct medication and you're monitored effectively, the benefit is more than the risk. So this is the end of my talk. I wanted to thank you again for having me. This is our most recent trip to beautiful Utah with Roger and Alicia and Greg, my husband. We immediately went for a tour and loved every minute of it. So thanks again for having me. And I'm going to pause here for any questions.
One question, a couple had to leave. She said, if you use sunscreen, are you inhibiting the absorption of vitamin D?
Excellent question. And the answer is yes. So those sun rays, I'm going to stop sharing the screen so that we can see each other better. So those sun rays that you are blocking by using a sunscreen is exactly what produces vitamin D in your skin. So if for whatever skin condition you actually have to use a sunscreen, then you're basically not making vitamin D.
Well, I have a question about vitamin D too. You sure. said that we could possibly have too much. Are there some subtle signs that we would know or should be aware of to ask our doctor then, I have this, so would you do the test?
So good news is that it is very difficult to get your vitamin D level to a high enough level that could actually develop symptoms because of it. I have seen two or three cases of what we call vitamin D toxicity, meaning that you have too much vitamin D in your body. And basically what happens is that after a certain threshold, it makes your calcium go up. It doesn't happen easily. Basically, those cases that I saw happened because the patient was inadvertently taking too much vitamin D. So one of them was this vitamin D supplement that is actually really easy to kind of buy on Amazon that looks like candy. So a patient was taking this, not even realizing how much vitamin D is in it. And in each one of them, there was 5,000 units of vitamin D, which is a lot. Most people need about 1,000. So this person was inadvertently taking too much vitamin D, like, you know, was just eating like candy. So it's not easy to make your vitamin D go high enough to actually cause symptoms. But if it happens, which is rare, the signs will be like headache and nausea, vomiting. So it's, I want to say, not that subtle, actually. But majority of physicians, when you go for your annual physical, checking your vitamin D once or twice a year is sort of like a standard. So if you are under medical care, I would be willing to bet that you probably have had your vitamin D level checked. Taking about 1,000 to 2,000 units a day is very low risk. And it's, I would say, impossible to lead to high enough levels that could cause a problem. So we're talking about like 5,000 a day, 10,000 a day. That would be too much. And you would only run into problem if you've been doing that for a while, not just like a week or two. Because as I said, vitamin D stores in your body. So if you just keep on putting more in and more in, then you kind of get to the flow, to the place where you're kind of overflowing and supersaturated. But it's not easy to do it.
Just as I'm walking to someone else, then what amount of calcium for someone, just as a matter of routine, is a good amount?
Yeah, so the official recommendation is 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day. Now, I don't want, I tell my patients, I don't want you to be like super nervous about, oh, did I get 1200 milligrams today? So we don't need to be sitting down and calculating our calcium intake. Generally, one serving of dairy, so let's say a cup of yogurt or a cup of milk has about 300 to 400 milligrams of calcium in it. So let's say if you have a cup of yogurt and then some greens with your dinner or a salad or things like that, that should probably get you to around 700-800 milligrams of calcium. And then if you have like a little bit of let's say you had cereal, or you had half an orange, or you had some nuts as a snack, a little here and a little there and a little there, it will get you to close to 1200. So no need to worry about, did I get my 1200 milligrams today from what I ate? What generally should do the job is having two things a day, most days, that have a good amount of calcium in them. And that would be the dairy and the greens. There are other sources of calcium too that sometimes you don't think about it. And if you get curious and you look at that Bone Health and Osteoporosis Foundation website, they actually have a table of all of the food items that have a good amount of calcium in it. So for example, we think about cheese. So mac and cheese would be a good source of calcium. Pizza would be a good source of calcium. Also, another thing that we don't think about is any kind of fish that comes in a can, because it gets canned with its bone. So tuna, for example, tuna can have calcium in it. Fresh tuna actually might not have a lot of calcium in it because they remove the bone, but a can of tuna has calcium in it. So if you have tuna sandwich, that gives you a good amount of calcium. Almonds give you a good amount of calcium. Tofu gives you a good amount of calcium. A lot of people don't like tofu. I don't like tofu, but you know, if you can hide it somewhere, then, or you like it, you can. That's another good source of calcium. So those are the main sources. If you have two of them a day, with a little bit from here and there, you'll get to close to 1200.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about vitamin D, is it D or is it D3?
So great question. There are two kinds of vitamin D over the counter. One of them is D2, the other one is D3. D2 comes from plant sources. The other name for it is ergocalciferol. D3 comes from animal sources, and the other name of it is cholecalciferol. There is some debate which one is better, and frankly, both of them are the same. So I tell my patients, get whatever bottle you like. It doesn't matter what manufacturer it is, and whether it's D2 or D3 doesn't matter. As long as it's like 1,000 to 2,000 a day, you're good. And remember that in your multivitamins also has vitamin D. It really depends. Some multivitamins have higher amounts of vitamin D in them, and some have lower amounts. So it might be anywhere between like 200 to 1,000. So you got to look on the bottle, on your vitamin D, on your multivitamin bottle, to see exactly how much vitamin D is in it.
And I have a question on the calcium too. There's two kinds of calcium, the calcium carbonate and then calcium citrate. So which calcium?
Exactly. Excellent question. So calcium carbonate, which is basically what is in Tums, is cheaper, but it can have a little bit more difficult time to get digested. So some people, if they can't have enough calcium in their food and they actually need to take a supplement, if they take Tums every day, they feel bloated, or, you know, they feel indigestion, or might get constipated. Calcium citrate, which is CitraCal, is more gentle on the stomach. And it's a little bit more expensive, but it's a little bit more gentle on the stomach. The calcium part of it is the same. It's the other part of it, which is the carbonate or the citrate, that determines how gentle it is on the stomach. There's one more difference between them, which is that calcium carbonate, or TUMS, needs stomach acid to be absorbed. So if you take medication to reduce your stomach acid, then you probably need to take the calcium citrate because then you can absorb it better. If you're trying to get your calcium from food, you don't have to worry about it. But this is just about the supplement, whether you're taking medicine for stomach acid or not.
And then what would be the best time to take your calcium?
So because calcium carbonate needs stomach acid, then it's better to take it with food. But calcium citrate, it doesn't matter.
Okay. Anyone else? Oh, just hold on a second. Do you have time, Beffa?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I have osteopenia, and I try to get a lot of greens in my diet, but I've read it from several places where they say that the oxalic acid, I believe it is, that's in spinach and Swiss chard, reduces calcium absorption. So I was wondering if that's really going to make all that much difference, you know, if I should stick with kale and some of those things, or that is the difference not significant enough to worry about?
Correct. It is not significant enough to worry about. What kind of, so as you pointed out, we're hearing various kinds of calcium citrate, calcium carbonate, calcium oxalate, and there's other forms of it too. These are different salts of calcium because there is something that is attached to the calcium. And the difference would not necessarily apply to the bone part. So for an example, some people who have kidney stones can't have too much oxalate. So in that scenario, then you need to avoid too much oxalate, not because of the bone, but because of the kidney stone. And the carbonate and the citrate that we just talked about, really the difference applies to stomach and digestion and things like that. But doesn't really have a difference when it comes to your bone.
Okay, thank you. I did have one other question too, and that is, as far as when you already have osteopenia, as far as trying to build bone with the weight training, is that going to just like maintain what you have, or can you actually increase your bone density with weight training?
You know, I have to say, you guys, your questions are amazing. So it really depends. Let me explain. And the same thing applies to calcium and vitamin D as well. It depends on where you're starting. So let's say if you are a person who has not really had any good intake of calcium and vitamin D for a while, and also are very sedentary, and you have osteopenia. Now you're going to start weight training and walking and taking calcium and taking vitamin D. Then you can actually have a meaningful improvement in your bone density. But if you're already reasonably active and you already have calcium in your food because you like to eat, you know, cereal with milk every day, and you're already taking vitamin D in your multivitamin, then doing more of those is probably not going to have a big impact. So depending on, and there is actually research showing this, that people who have poor intake of calcium and vitamin D just by taking calcium and vitamin D have a meaningful increase in their bone density and decrease in the risk of fracture. But people who already have a good intake for whatever reason, taking more of it, not going to make much of a difference, and the same thing applies to walking. So it really depends on where you start.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Anyone else? Carolyn, did you have something?
What do you think about having the Prolina?
Sorry.
What do you think about taking Prolia?
injections.
Right. So Prolia is one of very effective treatments for osteoporosis. It's very well tolerated, meaning that, you know, when you, for example, go get a vaccine, you feel a little achy and a little tired and maybe a little feverish for a few days. You feel nothing after taking Prolia, majority of people, and it's very effective. It's one of the best medications that we have available for treatment of osteoporosis. However, going back to what I said about, you know, who is it that is taking Prolia and what are the circumstances that they were diagnosed with osteoporosis and how many years they've had it and what other medications they took before going on Prolia. These are all really, really important. So my answer in terms of Prolia being a great option is a general answer. The one thing that is important about Prolia is if that is a medication that has been recommended to you, it's a every 6 months injection. So it's like a flu shot every 6 months. If that's the medication that has been recommended to you, it's very important to stick with the every 6 month schedule. So we gotta, I always tell patients to make sure when they get a dose to mark their calendar for 6 months later to make sure that they don't forget their dose. There's a little bit of flexibility. Like if you're traveling or something and you go 2 weeks later, that's okay. But if we forget our dose or just there's a big gap between the two doses, then it's not going to really work the way it should. And can also between those two doses, if there's a big delay, there could be a lot of bone loss that can happen in the interim. And that can have its own consequences. But in general, Prolia is a great medication.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Anyone else? Well, thank you very much. Thanks, everybody, for coming. And thank you, Vafa, for your time. And
thank you very much for having me. All right. It was great talking to you all.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.